It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. With just a few clicks of the keyboard or taps on your phone, you can instantly reach somebody in Portland or Vancouver, just not in person. Sure, you can get on an airplane or in your car, but that takes time, hours sometimes. My next guest wants to cut that trip time down to 15 minutes in the case of Portland. Mitchell Fremote is a junior at the University of Washington studying mechanical engineering. He directs a team of students building a Hyperloop pod. Mitchell, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What is Hyperloop?
So Hyperloop is essentially a form of high-speed transportation where you have, you can call them pods, or essentially small trains that run through a vacuum tube.
How small? Like I'm the only one in my pod, or is it it's a car?
To make it economical, it'd have to have at least room for a bunch of people. Probably, 10 to 20 would be my guess.
Okay.
But for what we're doing, it's a small scale pod, so it's going to be fit one person.
All right, pod shooting through a tunnel.
Yes.
Near supersonic speeds.
Above supersonic.
Above supersonic.
Yeah.
Seattle to Portland in 15 minutes. Is that true? Is that realistic?
If Hyperloop becomes a reality, then yeah, that's what it'll do.
180 miles between here and there. That's about 720 miles an hour.
Yep.
How does that work? How do you get that speed?
You get that speed because when you're in a vacuum tube, you don't have the air resistance. With, say, planes or trains, you have a lot of drag from the air resistance. And when you don't have that, it allows you to achieve a lot higher speeds. And that's about as simple as that.
So you're just being sucked through a vacuum tube?
It's not necessarily, I wouldn't call it sucked. There's different propulsion systems you can use. For the real Hyperloop, ideally the propulsion system would be built into the track. So probably end up being like a magnetic propulsion system. So you have linear induction motors or something of that sort in the track, and those propel the pod along the track.
I read that you're working on using a cold gas thruster.
We are using a cold gas thruster. Yeah,
that's what you're doing now.
Pretty cool. Yeah.
Have you built something that's cold gas and thrusting?
We're actually in the design phase right now. So we submit our final design package to SpaceX here in the next 2 weeks.
SpaceX is the Elon Musk company.
Yes.
Focused on space, but he's kind of sponsoring this Hyperloop competition.
Yeah. So they run the competition. They built a beautiful long tube for us. It's about 0.8 miles long. I think it's about 70 inches in diameter, if I'm correct on that. But it's amazing. Yeah, to have a facility like that to test your pod on, it's really fun.
How does the cold gas thruster work, basically?
Basically, it's a rocket. It's a rocket.
Is it like sitting in an office chair and squirting a fire extinguisher and rolling across the floor?
That's about it. Yeah, it's pretty simple. It's just conservation of momentum. You shoot mass one way and you go the other way. So in our case, we're shooting out nitrogen out the back of our pod, and that propels us forward.
How fast are you actually going to get a pod to move?
Our goal is actually 200 miles an hour.
Okay.
You're kind of limited by the small length of the tube. To reach super high speeds in that tube, you're going to need extremely high propulsion and braking forces, so high G-forces, something that no human could handle. But our G-forces aren't ridiculously high. But to give you a sense of scale, the team that won last year, the German team from the Technical University of Munich, they reached 200 miles an hour using an electric propulsion system with wheels. So
your cold gas thruster is not actually what would eventually power a Hyperloop.
Probably not.
So why are you, is it just to get people excited? Is this more of a marketing the idea?
A little bit, yeah. It's to get people excited about Hyperloop, thinking about Hyperloop, and as well as to get young engineering students involved in a cool project on working on something that's never been done before.
This sounds like a great thing to study, and we'll learn from it. Are you and I seriously going to rocket to Portland in 15 minutes? Realistically, what are the odds?
I'd say it's probably going to happen. The timeline is the issue for me. I'd say maybe 15, 20 years before something like that happens. Just with a giant vacuum tube, we would end up being the largest vacuum chamber in the world, even if you went Seattle to Portland or San Fran to LA. Yeah, that kind of thing is really hard to make, and there's a lot of issues that come up with building a vacuum tube that big, and how do you make it safe? How do you essentially prevent failure? Because failure in a vacuum tube would probably be catastrophic. So there's a lot of engineering challenges with the infrastructure as well. But we specifically work on the pod.
You're working on the pod. What is it like, Mitchell, to work on a project that might be fantastical. It sounds like science fiction. What is it like for you?
It's awesome because I'll go back to competition one. We pushed through all the rigorous testing procedure that SpaceX has for you, and we actually got a test pod in the big tube. And so we got to run down the big tube, and I was part of the manufacturing and the design of the braking system. And so when your pod starts to get up to speed, you get a little scared because you're like, okay, now my braking system really has to work or this thing's going to crash. And everything, even though it was a low speed run, everything worked out perfectly and we were all high-fiving, and it was a lot of fun. That was probably my favorite moment of Hyperloop so far. But yeah, hoping to have another few of those in the future.
That's my favorite part of the Hyperloop trip is the brakes. I really want, in my 720 mile per hour trip, I'm highly interested in the brakes working well.
Yep, exactly. Yeah.
So well done.
Yeah. That's, I mean, the propulsion system's the fun part, the part that makes it go fast. But if the brakes don't work, then you're in trouble. So,
Mitchell Fremont, don't forget to do your actual class study as well, okay?
I'll try.
Okay.
I'll try.
Junior at the University of Washington, studying mechanical engineering, but we met him because he directs the University of Washington's Hyperloop team, trying to get us from, for example, Seattle to Portland in 15 minutes someday.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So as you just heard, Mitchell thinks Hyperloop could happen in 15 or 20 years. Let's talk Hyperloop and other transit futures with Mark Hallenbeck, director of the State Transportation Center at University of Washington. Welcome back, Mark.
Thanks. I'm always happy to be here.
What do you think? Seattle to Portland in 15 minutes within 20 years?
No.
No?
No.
How come? This is a hardworking young man. He seems to...
The technology might work. Yeah. You know, there's Hyperloop could come. That part, the technology, it's kind of like automated cars. The technology could very well show up. The real question is the financial side. Does it actually make financial sense to build a 180-mile tube? And where are you going to put the 180-mile tube? So if you look at Elon Musk, his next giant company, a really, really important company, is called the Boring Company. And it's boring because it builds tunneling machines. And so their test right now is in LA. Can they make a tunneling machine that makes the tunnel inexpensive enough that they can get it in to Portland?
Okay. Well, then that sounds like it could, the answer to the right-of-way thing.
So that's the answer to the right-of-way, but now you're still doing tunneling. So the typical numbers are if it costs X to build something on the ground, it costs 1.5X to put it up in the air, and it costs 2 to 3X in the ground. Mm. And so if you think of high-speed rail as being expensive because you have to buy the right-of-way and build a rail, multiply by 3, okay? Or, oh, golly gee whiz, you only have to multiply by 1.5. So it's the, and can I charge enough for this trip going to Portland to actually recoup the money? That's
But you know, train tracks at one time seemed impractical and a freeway system. I just interviewed an astronaut, for God's sake, you know, International Space Station. It takes investment, time, commitment, all that. Why couldn't Hyperloop be that kind of project?
Oh, Hyperloop could. You gave me a time frame, and I balk at the time frames.
Okay.
I balk at the time frame because you have to line up you have to prove the technology, you have to line up the money, and then you have to build this thing. And you add those together, and my gut reaction is, yeah, 15 years, no chance on Earth. 20, well, you know, maybe. Just because of the level of construction, but you're still a ways off from actually supplying that technology and making sure it works. I mean, it's cool stuff. It's great theoretics. Yeah, can they really do it? And again, the whole safety factor of can you keep a tube in vacuum at, you know, for 180 miles? How do you deal with it? How do you build stations associated with those tubes? There's an awful lot technologically to do. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if they prove the technology, yeah, it'll come. The only question is, what's the time frame?
What about a 15-minute ride from Seattle to Portland in an hour? Governor Inslee said last month he's optimistic about a high-speed train to connect. Actually, he was talking about Vancouver, B.C. and Seattle. Mm-hmm. How far along is the high-speed rail project in Washington?
They're looking for money. So
There's
money. It's not that, at least in high-speed rail, you understand basically everything you need to know about it. You know how much it'll cost to build. You know how fast it'll run. You know what the characteristics look like. Their problem really is how do you start and end it in Vancouver, BC, and Seattle and Portland? Do you build it cheaply and go to Tukwila and somehow connect it to the airport? Do you figure out how to get it into downtown Seattle? So again, this is why Musk has said, oh, I guess I better figure out a cheaper way to do tunneling. Because if you can find a cheap way to do tunneling, you're not spending $2, $3, $4 billion on the tunnel in downtown Seattle.
Yeah.
But now you're doing, you know, again, you got to figure you have to be in tunnel from Everett to Tacoma because there's not much of a place to bring it up. And so those aspects are the detriment. That's what's really limiting high-speed rail because the cost of going in those areas is so high in traditional manner that you're not sure you can make enough money from the system to pay it off.
Okay. And of course, we just had this Amtrak train going too fast, in December, killed three people, 79 miles an hour, 30 mile an hour zone. What safety measures do you think need to be figured out before? What do you think about the Amtrak dilemma? What's the lesson?
First, high-speed rail is on separated track. They are not allowed to share track with freight trains. They have to be on their own rail for a variety of reasons. So you have to have your own two railroad tracks, one northbound, one southbound, which means you need new space for those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So that is the ultimate rule of high-speed rail. It is on grade separated right-of-way. Yeah. I don't have anything that the papers haven't already talked about in terms of the crash. I don't know why, but you actually have to have control of train speeds and make sure that they are for what the track is marked for. So positive train control, that'll help. Got to make sure that technology works and it's in place.
You know, we've been talking about the future of transportation with Mark Hallenbach from the State Transportation Center. Right? State Transportation. What's it
close
called?
Close enough.
Yeah.
University of Washington's
Washington State Transportation Center. And I want to talk about the present-day transportation in our cars because the Seattle City Council, the head of the Land Use Planning Zoning Committee, is proposing reducing parking in the city in favor of more transit. Now, this has been talked about a long time, but we have transit coming online. We have ride shares. We have more and more alternatives to parking. Is this, do you think, the time to talk about not forcing new residential buildings to build parking spaces, reducing parking in areas where there's a mass transit option?
So I'm not a person of extremes, so I never like to say no parking, right? I just don't like that because people do bring vehicles to the city.
We're talking about reductions.
Right. So, but on the other hand, a reduction, particularly as you grow activity levels, population, employment, as you grow those, you want the vast, vast, vast majority of all of those new trips to be in something other than an automobile because there's no space for it. So you want to do the things that make that happen. Now, I just spent my pre-Christmas week in Strasbourg, France, and in Colmar, and those are the whole central city of Strasbourg. The only vehicles you see are service vehicles in delivering goods. People walk, they take the trams. The trams work because there's nothing in the way.
How's the weather in the hills in Strasbourg?
It was actually, the weather was Seattle. It was high 30s and drizzling.
Okay.
And people riding bikes all over through the drizzle without wearing good protective rain gear. They were just wearing their normal clothes. I was surprised at that.
Hilly? Flat?
Strasbourg itself is pretty flat. The hills are outside of the city.
Oh.
But again, those things work. You can. There are lots of places in the world that have shown that those things work. But you have to have ways to get people in. You have to have ways to get people out. You have to have ways to get people around. In an area that's lacking in space, then you go to higher capacity, more dense modes of travel. And so that doesn't mean adding car space. That means reducing car space.
We just have a minute left, and you and I were talking before the microphones turned on about the crashes on Seattle streetcars. This woman was killed on Yesler Way, and her brother is suing the city, claiming that the city could have made streetcars safer, should have, and didn't.
I'm not an expert on streetcar wheel design. I can't comment on that and how that does the route. What I can say is the way that Norwegians and most of the Europeans deal with it is they don't ride street bikes. They ride mountain bikes, big, fat knobby tires.
I didn't know that.
And the big fat knobby tires are too big to go into the tracks. So you can still slip on metal, because metal is slick, but you can't actually drop your wheel down into the track. So if you're riding, that's Mark's recommendation to you. If you're going to ride a bike in an area that has streetcar tracks, ride bigger tired bikes.
Okay.
It's safer.
Some of the other ideas for Seattle have been putting rubber filler in the grooves, choosing a different kind of rail, I guess they could have, just excluding bicycles from the streetcar lane. But in the meantime, yeah, I got some big fat tires. Use that.
It's a great thing that you can do.
Yes. And we've been talking with Mark Hallenbeck, and he's with the University of Washington's Washington State Transportation Center. Thanks for coming and talking about the future and the now. Thank you.
Always happy to be here.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. That's it for today. Glad you listened with us. The show is put together by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Bon Huberman, Jason Pagano, Jeannie Yandel. I'm Bill Radke, and I hope you'll join us tomorrow as we wrap up the news on the Week in Review.